Welcome back to On a Mission, the show where you get to listen to inspired and inspiring people talk about their lives and their purpose. In other words, their mission in the world. You're listening to episode 10. It's season 2. I'm your host, Maulene Dupree Dominguez. I'm a minister, teacher, writer, and general people enthusiast living in the beautiful Bay Area of California. I can't wait to share some of my favorite people with you. Today, I'm talking with Brian Stanley, an education nonprofit executive living in Oakland. He's a Black Catholic man raising two Black boys along with his amazing wife, Celeste. He talks about his time at St. Mary's College, a school run by a Catholic order of brothers called the Christian Brothers. We also talked about his experience at the one and only St. Columba Catholic Church in North Oakland, where Black heritage and Catholicism come together every day. Our conversation covers his work in the educational nonprofit world, the ways his faith influences his quarantine, and why he thinks white people are waking up to racist policies in the United States now. Listen in.
So you've really been in the nonprofit world, and specifically, for the most part, the educational nonprofit world, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. That was my jam.
How would you characterize the mission of, like, not just those organizations, but your role, like, within educational nonprofit work?
When I think about the work of the educational nonprofits I worked for, it was more or less supplemental to the public education system. The policy works a little different, but everything else was more or less supplemental, trying to, in some cases, mitigate the worst effects of our public education system. Was often the case, trying to figure out how we got the very best set of outcomes from a system or context that were pretty well designed to not give you great outcomes. So a lot of supplemental programs, a lot of backfill programs, a lot of things that maybe the system should do, but they're not going to. And we're trying to focus on how do we help this kid get what they need.
Yeah. In your estimation, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, what do you think are kind of the top 2, 3, 4, like, most egregious gaping holes in public education in California?
That's just a tiny little question.
You know.
I think the biggest issue, it was funny, I was on Twitter with someone, and there was some article someone had written about, there are these, that, you know, basically families, privilege, primarily white families, but upper class families, upper middle class families like mine, are forming pods, right? They're hiring teachers, forming a pod. People are like, you should invest your efforts in the public system. And I'm like, really? Because the public system, as has been designed, has produced the same set of results for the same kids. And someone on Twitter said, you're right, and white families know they're going to be fine. And I've heard that before, and I think that's generally how folks think, but it occurred to me in this moment, I don't know why I hadn't thought about this before, what does it mean knowing that your kids will be fine? Right? If you knew your family could never get COVID, never, you were permanently immune, and you couldn't pass your immunity on to somebody else, it was just yours, what would you do right now? Right? You would do whatever you wanted. I'm going to the cafe. Right? I'm going to go to the beach. It's empty. I'm not wearing a mask. Who needs a mask? Right? You'd run up and down the street with no mask, breathing freely on everybody. And so what does it mean that we have a whole group of people in our country who believe that no matter what's wrong with the public education system, my kids will be fine? Does it mean that you stand in the way of making changes to that system that might be much more radical than you're comfortable with? Probably.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Does it mean that you will organize and advocate to protect your privileges at the expense of someone else because my kids will be fine? Probably. And so I think the core problem, or one of the core problems, is that we are far more comfortable with outrageously bad results for Black and Brown children than we care to admit. So in Oakland, I say this all the time, 90% of Black boys are not proficient in math in middle school. 1 in 4 Black boys graduates high school qualified for admission to the state university system. The list of explanations as to why that's okay is long. The list of what the heck outrage is much shorter. A few years ago, we funded a study with OUSD, Oakland Unified School District, to look at the structure of the school day, because the superintendent at the time said, I don't think our kids aren't actually doing enough class time. And I think that's a problem. Okay. We found that over half the high schools were configured such that it was impossible for you to graduate A through G qualified. This was like 2016. Half the high schools. Middle schools had among the low, middle and elementary schools had among the least numbers of instructional hours given to a child in the state of California. And so the question was, and so I remember I saw this where I was livid. I was over the moon. I was like, this is outrageous. This is 20, how dare we? There was hardly a chatter about it, right? The people who come to the school board organized about, we hate charters, were like, yeah, well, you know, well, I don't know what to tell you. That's what happens sometimes. I guess we should fix it. I mean, it was, in comparison to the usual things people scream about, the actual structure of the system that is replicating the injustice was viewed as, meh, what are we going to do, right? Now, in this case, the superintendent said, oh, well, this is all right. We're going to do something about this. So they modified the calendars at high schools, created more space. We had schools where the teachers were fighting this, saying, we don't want to do this.
Uh-huh.
And that is on something that's pretty high profile. That happens all the time in public education, where the resistance to progress that would actually work to make the system more just is actually the norm. Right. And people are shocked by it. But I'm like, why are we shocked? And B, what does this say about us that we resist making the changes that could go a long way to alleviating the replication of unjust outcomes, unless the replication of unjust outcomes is what we actually want? So I think we're too comfortable. I think we've grown far too comfortable with injustice in public education. And I think until that changes, everything is just, we'll do this cycle, right? We'll try to do something different. It'll get really hard and really complicated, and it might not work. And then we'll regress back to the mean.
Yeah, that's so interesting to me now too, given this forced, like you just said, this forced reality now where we cannot do school the way that we always have. Yeah. We are forced to think of a new way to do school, which, to your point, ought to be an opportunity like no other, but the political will for our neighbors' children mm-hmm. just isn't there.
Yeah, it is the note was Lisa Delpit, Other People's Children. I think it's in her book from decades ago.
Yes.
I think it's the same concept, right? It's other people's children. How much do I care about other people's children? What am I willing to do for other people's children?
That's right.
The fact that I could, you know, my older kid doesn't go to OUSD school anymore. He did. It was a challenging experience, to put it mildly. My younger kid does. It's a pretty challenging experience. Other families of our class strata more or less only send their kids to the same handfuls of schools. And if they don't get their kids into those schools, they send them to whatever private school makes sense for them. One more story, my kid's school, Kaiser, was being merged with Sankofa, and it has since been merged to Sankofa United. The response from white upper class families who send their kids to the school to Kaiser, which is way up in the hills, a more or less inaccessible part. The school was built primarily because the district in the 1960s was deeply concerned about white flight and that there were too many black kids going to schools where white folks had historically gone to, and so those families are moving to the hills. And we have a ton of schools that are too small, unsustainably small. It's terrible policy. They knew it was terrible policy, but they did it anyway because they were trying to keep white families in the system. That was their stated policy priority, which is insane to me now, but makes a whole lot of sense. And at least they said it. Maybe that's the same policy priority now. We just don't say it. So when that happened, the level of resistance and recalcitrance and we want to keep what's ours up here versus saying, this is, they got mad at me quite a bit. I don't really care. But they got mad at me quite a bit. And I was like, I'm confused. If we think that we are good at educating children and we have a community that is desperate to strengthen the education of their children, and we're both too small to stay open, but together we can be mighty. I'm confused what we're fighting. This feels like the right and just outcome. We should do this. And people were like, but no, it's a mine. And I'm like, you're not gonna lose nothing except the shorter commute up the hill. What you talking about? So my point is, this is what's norm in our society and in our country for a long time.
Oh, and it's so deep, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
It is.
You know, I hesitate to say this because this isn't going to mean anything to you, but you know, we white people here in the East Bay congratulate ourselves 100 times a day on our progressive, multicultural commitment to diversity. Mm-hmm. And then when the rubber meets the road and you want to merge two schools in Oakland, all of that nice chatter goes right out the window.
Yeah. And I do think, there's a reason why I live in Oakland and not someplace, not Oakland.
I know, that's true for a lot of us.
Right? There's much I enjoy about this community, but I do think there is a way in which putting a Black Lives Matter banner on your door is a good act, but that doesn't actually rebalance the equation towards more justice. It really doesn't. Taking your kids to a march is a good thing. You should do that. That is a good message into your children. Absolutely. But what's actually more important to me is, so when you're in the organization that you lead, how many people of color, how many Black folks, Latino folks, immigrant folks are in your leadership? How are those voices listened to and honored and brought in as co-equal partners in leadership? Like, if the answer to that question is, well, no, actually, my board's all white, my leadership team's all white, it's like, then there's a disconnect there, right? That at some level, to me, it's just about power. Like, if you're not about sharing the power or putting people in positions of power who don't look like you and who have a different worldview than you, then what are you really doing? And at that point, it's just marketing and window dressing. And again, there's value maybe for someone in that, but that's not going to actually flip the switch to a more just and equitable community or society.
Right. It's the performative versus the substantive.
There you go.
Yeah. No, I really, really agree. Yeah. Moving from the performative into the substantive, and mm-hmm. from the shallow to the deep, from mm-hmm. the short term to the lifetime mm-hmm. commitment. What is your advice for the person who's listening to this podcast who has taken a few steps towards mm-hmm. racial justice, towards educational equity, towards anything along those lines, and they want to keep going?
Mm-hmm. So a few different thoughts on that. So one, I'd say, you can't get better at what you don't know and understand. So I'm not going to knock Robin D'Angelo or Kendi Abraham's book, either White Fragility or How to Be Anti-Racist. Those are important tools for people who need that. I also would say reading authors, the Baldwins and the Morrisons, and the DeMarquette. I mean, there are tons of just brilliant authors and thinkers who I think will give you a more forceful articulation of reality and what the stakes are. So I would encourage folks to read deeply. It's like when people say, I had no idea that police did this, or I didn't know racism was real. I'm like, what are you talking about? If you know that, that's on you. Like they literally in every community and in many neighborhoods in any city or any town have these buildings where they're chock full of books and they let you take them out for free. Just walk in, show them where you live. They're like, oh, okay, you can take this book, bring it back in 2 weeks. Great. So you can do this. So I think, you know, I don't have a lot of tolerance, people say, but I didn't know. No, you just chose to pay attention. It's one of the reasons why I'm not a big fan of implicit bias, because I actually don't want to let people off the hook for their commitment to racist ideas. You knew that shit was wrong when you knew it. Stop acting like you brand new at this. You old enough to know better. TJ might have some implicit bias because he's 12. Okay, fine. Someone who's 25? Come on, man. Come on, crack a book. So that's one. I'd say read deeply, read and read with curiosity. And be curious about someone else's lived experience, particularly when it is abundantly clear that you're having an impact on that lived experience, whether you are conscious, whether you are intentional about it or not. I think the other thing I would say is, recognize that it took centuries to build the systems that we have now.
Yeah.
Of dedicated, committed effort by a lot of people, centuries.
Yes.
They will not be unwound in 24 hours. They will not be unwound by your amazing protest. They will not be unwound because the school board says we're committed to being anti-racist. They will not be unwound because your church says we will make room for LGBTQ+ people in leader. None of that's going to be unwound by that. It will take a long time to unwind it. And so there's something to where I often tell folks, if you think you're going to fix this in a year, you will burn yourself out, you will get frustrated, and you'll walk away from it. And we will lose you in the fight, and we need you in the fight for the long term. So that's what I'd say. Read deeply, recognize there's an enormous amount of work to be done. I don't want to say pace yourself, but move with urgency. But also recognize if you try to do it all, you burn yourself out. And then that's actually how that system wins, right? It knows it's difficult to deal with. It assumes you will get more tired before it gets tired. And so that's not what you want.
It is. It is a relentless beast. Like you said, that has hundreds, really maybe even 1,000 years behind it.
Yep.
And it's like, oh, little white lady, you think you're going to come for me? Guess who's coming for you?
Right. That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
That is so, really well put. Tell us more about who taught you about your faith.
Well, my grandmother was super important to me in that. She died in 2008, I think. She's like 93. So she had a good solid run. I think she got to see Obama elected, which was cool. It meant a lot to her. But I think she's a woman. She grew up as a sharecropper on a farm back in Louisiana in the 19 whatever it was. She's a tough lady. And she saw some stuff. She didn't talk about it all the time, but she didn't have to. You knew. And she had a faith that animated her, helped her navigate a world that was harsh and cruel to her, and helped her navigate that world with a level of grace and dignity that I think was important to me. And so she's the one who would say, it's nice to be nice. Like, just be nice. It's okay. It doesn't make you weaker to be nice to someone. If someone's having a rough day and they're acting out, treating them with kindness will help them maybe more than it helps you. So that was her. She was super important to me. My time at St. Mary's, I think there are lots of Christian brothers who modeled a type of faith that was really inspiring and refreshing to me. And, you know, then my wife, who is, you know, who is you know, has a level of kindness and is quick to remind me when I'm being impatient with the children. And it's like, you should be kinder to them. They will get it, but if they will hear it if you're kinder, and maybe extend them some grace to be sloppy and messy and inefficient as 10 and 12 and a half year olds, to which I'm like, what? They don't have it all together at 10 and a half and 12? Outrageous.
I feel you so much on that.
So yeah, I think that's how I've tried to internalize an understanding of faith that hopefully helps me leave the world better than I found it.
Yeah, totally. What did you like most about the way the Christian Brothers approached faith? Like, you called it fresh, I think. What was refreshing about it?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I loved about the Christian Brothers that sort of modeled for me a type of faith is I think they, you know, there was an orientation towards making the world more just that really resonated with me. I think, you know, there was a way in which I could experience Christianity as talked about in sort of white suburban communities like Moraga as being pretty fake. Like, what are you talking about, justice? You have this beautiful house, you live up here, there are no people of color near you unless they're serving you. What's that about? And I think there was a different animation that I experienced with a number of the brothers that really saw that tension and tried to reconcile it towards justice, right? So I thought that was interesting. You know, I think, and then when I met Celeste, I started going to St. Columba, which is a Black Catholic church in North Oakland. That's where we go now. And that was also a site where sort of the blending of what I knew growing up as sort of Black church or traditional Black church with some of the elements, some of the Catholic social teaching elements, and sort of blending those two things together, that was pretty cool. That was pretty impactful on me. So I think the brothers sort of pushed to say, no, we actually have to be about justice. In the places where we cannot serve the poor, we will stand in solidarity with them. And so this notion of solidarity with the poor, and yes, that's dated language. It was 1963. These things happen. But I think that notion of solidarity was something that they struggled through at with St. Mary's. And some days it was good, and some days it was like, oof, got to work on the solidarity, people. Got to work on the solidarity, baby. What we doing? But the struggle was real, as the young people might say these days. And so I think I respected that they were like, no, we're gonna wrestle through this. We may come up with an answer that's not the best answer, we're clear, but we're gonna keep fighting to get to the best answer. And I respected that. I really did.
Yeah. Can we dive in on the Black man raising Black boys thing?
Okay.
What's your life like right now?
You know, I think it is a strange time in America where folks are talking about race and racism with a level of energy that is not new, because we talk about race and racism in my home, because I'm raising two Black boys in a world where lots of people are perfectly happy to see them fail. And so preparing them to helping them navigate that reality, because it's not about preparing them for something that's coming. It is helping them navigate what is. So that is just a pretty normal thing for us. I think what's different is those conversations or elements of those conversations are taking place in public, with white folk, or with folks for whom this is they're brand new to this conversation. That is unusual and different, and in some ways hopeful and good, and in other ways anxiety provoking, because there will be, there is already, and there will continue to be the inevitable backlash to these things. You know, every time you push for racial justice and you begin to achieve something, there are routinely people who view this as a zero sum game, and so success for one comes at the cost for someone else, and people don't like to give up nothing. So I do think, you know, so in this time, I guess it's there are moments of hope, there are moments of exhaustion, there are moments of anxiety, there are moments of shock, there are moments of, oh, okay, that seems like something you should have done before, but glad you're here now.
Better late than never, eh?
Better late than never, friend. So that's me.
Yeah. I mean, it does strike me that, of course, it, like you said, in your home, these conversations have been a fact of the matter forever, and that now you're hearing them maybe in different spaces, or finally some white folks are waking up to that reality, maybe even just a tiny bit, and it must be, yeah, interesting to witness that. Mm-hmm. I'll ask you, in your opinion, and then I want to get back to the backlash thing. Why now, do you think? Why now?
Oh, I mean, I think it's a function of the president. I think Donald Trump has, you know, there. I think Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote an Atlantic article, right? I believe after the stuff with the owner of the Clippers, Donald Sterling, had come out. I think he said, he told his then girlfriend, I don't want you hanging around Magic Johnson and all these black guys. And it was some absurdly racist thing that his then, I think, girlfriend recorded and promptly shared with the media. And people were like, oh my God, I can't believe David Sterling is Donald Sterling's a horrible rapist. People were like, he was sued repeatedly by the DOJ for discriminatory housing and settled those lawsuits, because he was doing it and didn't care, and he was getting rich from doing it. And so to pretend that we are suddenly shocked doesn't make sense, unless you believe that for some folks, the racism in and of itself isn't the issue. It is that Donald Trump is behaving rather boorishly with his racism. We prefer a better class of racist, I think, was Ta-Nehisi Coates' point. And so right. And so we prefer our dog whistles and our codes, because then we have enough room to hide behind that and say, no, he didn't mean that. He meant that. And then we play this game, when the facts don't mean what the facts say. So I think Donald Trump has blown the lid off of that. He doesn't operate with racial whistles. He operates with racial foghorns. And so I think folks have been heightened in a way that just feels uncomfortable for people who normally might bristle at the notion that America has some pretty deep historic and both historic and current issues with racism and how we've structured society. They may have bristled at that 5 years ago. Now they're like, yeah, there's some mess. So I think that has added to this moment. You know, everything from the Unite the Right rallies to the stuff on the border with the undocumented kids and all that stuff. Yeah. So I think that's one pocket. And then I do think, you know, the sort of drumbeat over the last decade or so of videos showing the police abusing people is just stunning. Again, I think I said this once before somewhere, that, you know, my neighbor, Mike, as a grown up, you just assumed the police were going to come beat your ass at one point in time. Yeah. You hoped it wasn't too bad. You hoped you didn't go to jail. You hoped you could move on with your life.
Yeah.
But you just assumed at some point in time, I'm going to have a serious issue. I need to do something different. And in the era of camera phones, as every person has a camera phone on them, or most people do, so there's a camera within 2 feet of everybody at every time here, means that people can see that. And it's hard to reconcile, right, that disconnect between whatever George Floyd had done did not merit having someone kneel on his neck for 8 minutes and 29 seconds and suffocate him. There's no universe where that makes any sense, or whatever Breonna Taylor didn't do anything, but whatever the police thought they were dealing with didn't merit a woman who was just sleeping in her own bed in her own house getting shot and killed. Like, none of that makes any sense. So I think there's a level of for 10 years, 10, 15, 12 years, you've been seeing these videos or hearing these stories in a very public way, that has felt different and has felt challenging and feels, it has felt deeply uncomfortable. So I think you have the discomfort with the president's openly white supremacist and white nationalist rhetoric. You have the artifacts of pretty trenchant police misconduct directly in front of your face. And then I think the third piece is folks are much more aware of inequality, right? In the COVID moment, people are very much aware of, I can sit my butt at home. I have a great paying job. I help run a foundation. I can stay at home for years and it won't bother me. And yet my neighbors across the street may very well be struggling immensely financially. And if there's no rent more, if there's no eviction moratorium or no supplemental income, they're going to lose their job, they're going to lose their house, and they'll join the homeless encampment six blocks away from here. And people I think are very aware of that in a visceral way. You see it, you drive past it. You have family who've experienced it. And so I think that sensitivity to inequality, heightened sensitivity to inequality right in front of our face, I think it just led to folks say, this is some crap. And we got to do something better. And I don't know what better looks like. I'm not sure what it is. But if we don't do something, this is unacceptable. So.
Yeah, I really agree. I really resonate with everything that you just said, especially and including the bald inequalities that are exposed during the COVID. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Some of us literally, like you said, can just sit at home and do our work on the computer, and other people got to hustle and keep delivering UPS packages and mm-hmm. keep exposing mm-hmm. themselves, mm-hmm. not to mention pick strawberries and pave the streets and all this stuff and keep putting themselves at risk mm-hmm. just to be able to feed their kids.
Yep. Yep. And I think that, you know, again, I think it was impressed upon me when this started. I was like, there are a lot of people that depend on me buying their services, right? Mm-hmm. Our barber depends on us to go every 2 weeks to get a haircut. It's worked for a long time. Suddenly, he's like, yeah, I have to close my shop, don't I? And I'm like, I'll keep paying you. Don't sweat it. Don't give me a haircut. These are not for future haircuts. This is just, let's assume as if you did.
Yeah.
I'll be at home growing a nice beard and what's left of my hair all the way out. Then when I see you, I'll keep paying you. You can resume. We'll go back to normal. But you know, there are lots of folks for whom that's just real, right? Your gardeners, your janitors in our building, the food service companies that we hire catering from every couple of weeks for our staff. Like, it just, and you, we just aren't conscious of it. And there's sort of every person is their own economy. And when that system is disrupted, it's disrupted for everyone below them in the chain, right? So I think and there's something in that that also means that people's basic security, the further you go down the hierarchy, is less stable, right? So if you are someone who's wholly dependent upon someone going to sit in my chair every 2 weeks and get the haircut, and they can't do that because it's not safe, then how are you going to pay your rent, right? How are you going to pay the people that count on you?
That's right.
And so it's I think it's a stunning, it's an indictment of a system that we already knew was unjust. It's just the unjustness is now smacking us in the face to the extent that you, again, people can ignore, right? There are people who cheered when Trump said, the president said, we should keep meatpacking plants open. Those folks are dying. The folks are getting terribly sick and they're dying in droves. And the disconnect between, like, so is this so I can get a steak?
Yeah.
Working at home this week? Because honestly, I'm good with no steak. I could probably stand to lose not having a steak tonight anyway, if that means those folks get to be safe with their families. But that's not how our society is set up.
It's a fundamental dehumanization, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is, I think you know, when you choose to make, when you view people as means, not ends. I think it might have been, maybe it was Buber or someone, some philosopher said, people are never means, they're only ends.
Yes.
But in our society, we view people as means a lot.
Oh yeah. Capitalism itself, right? Demands that people are means.
That's right. So I think the cost of that is now apparent, right? That lots of folks are going to come out of this situation harmed substantially, both economically and physically and psychologically, because our society was viewing them more or less as means to achieve a set of ends. And we'll be reckoning with this for a generation. I mean, this is not something that just happens for a few weeks and we're good. Like, we got a minute in this state, and the costs of this will be exceptionally high in our society.
That is becoming more and more clear to me every day.
Yeah.
When I look at my own daughter, and I'm sure you do with your kids too, I'm like, this is going to color her whole growing up. She's 6 years old. This is still going to be a thing in a decade.
Mm-hmm.
16, that we'll still be sorting out the ramifications of everything that's going on right now. It's quite intimidating to me to contemplate that.
I mean, if you think of someone that graduated high school in 2000, in 2000 to 2020, they've experienced not one but two global recessions of significant impact on their earnings.
Yes.
9/11.
Yep.
The election of Barack Obama, the election of Donald Trump.
Yep.
And COVID.
Yep.
And both from an economic perspective and a cultural one, it will be, again, the impact on our society is tremendous. I mean, just think, we have children who now have missed an entire year, entire half year of school. I don't actually think schools will be fully reopened and anything that feels normal until fall 2021.
Agreed.
So that means kids have missed 18 months of school. Typically, if a child has missed 18 months of school, you don't call CPS. You had to do some stuff to be like, where is this baby at? We need to get them in some building. Yep. What's going on here? What do you need to get your baby to school every day?
That's right.
And so we're talking about a year to a year and a half of interrupted formal education in a public education system that struggled to educate everyone well, right? Mm-hmm. Or it put it differently, it succeeded in its job of undereducating the same people that have been undereducated for a long time. And so when those kids go back, we're going to put them in the grade they should be in by age.
Right.
But they're not actually ready for that grade, right? And so it will take a decade plus to some combination of adjusting what it means to be in sixth grade, let's say, down, catching kids. I mean, it will test the capacity of, and that's just public education. That isn't, and it has implications on, well, what job do I give someone? How do I help them get through college if they've missed a year of school? Like, it just compounds and compounds and compounds in ways that, in a country where we don't, where it's in lots of places, we don't have access to the types of jobs that you could get and build a solidly, what we would call middle-class life, without without a college degree. Like, that's not true in the Bay Area. It's really hard in the Bay Area. Oh. And so lots of folks are going to be in that boat. It remains to be seen how we're going to dig ourselves out of this and how long it takes.
Right. Can we go back to your barber?
Yep.
Brian, what made you know that the right thing to do was to keep paying your barber?
Oh, I mean, I have an excellent income. I don't have a lot of needs that I'm not able to meet myself. And I felt like what I told him was, as long as I'm working, I'll keep paying you. If that should change, I'll let you know. I didn't have any other people I had services that were dependent upon me, but we don't go to restaurants. We order in, you know, at least once or twice a week. We Whenever we can, we try to shop at the local grocery store that's a few blocks from our house to West Oakland. If I can buy it from the corner store, I'm like, yeah, they got, I'm gonna go down there and buy some baking powder and some milk there. I don't really care. It's fine. We do that. If there are, if there are local businesses that we can support, we try to support them as best we can. I think the reason why I thought that is, again, it's, you know, I have an attitude about money that says it's just money. And, I am fortunate enough to be able to still earn it. And I should do my part to help those who, for right now, this may be really difficult for them to see the light at the end of the tunnel. I'm making no one's house note. That's not going to happen. But if my little part helps you get through this moment, then I'm happy to help you get through this moment.
So it's just money. A lot of people listening are going to think, oh, well, he must have grown up with money.
Oh, no, did not. I think my attitude towards money really comes a bit out of my faith. And so far as, you know, we're not put here, again, people who have good incomes and are solidly upper middle class can get away with saying this, so I'm clear that there is privilege in me being able to state that it's just money to me. But it also comes from the fact that ultimately, we are here in this world, in this life for a finite amount of time. And there's something weird and twisted when people lose sight of our common humanity first and put our stuff and things in the way of that. And I just don't want to be that way. That's not how I want to show up with people. So I tend to think of it's just money to me really means I'm happy to give you and share with you what I have if that will help you move through the world better.
Yeah, that's good.
Thank you
so much, Brian. It was great to chat with you.
It was great to chat with you. Good to see you. Love to the family. You seem to be glowing and doing well as always.
Well, I'm faking it well.
Thanks for listening to On a Mission. I hope you took something from my conversation with Brian. I will continue to ponder why we as communities continue to be satisfied with the academic underperformance of Black students, especially Black males. That is a mission for my own teaching practice. Make sure you also listen to the New York Times recent podcast, Nice White Parents. I'll link it in the show notes. Speaking of show notes, head over to MaleneDupreeDominguez.com, where I will link books that Brian mentioned, and St. Mary's College, and more information on the Christian Brothers. See you over there at MaleneDupreeDominguez.com. And I have a special request for you. Let's make it easier for other folks to find the podcast and get inspired for their missions. Please rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a written review. This helps other people find us. Also, please share the podcast with your family and friends. Teach your favorite aunt how to subscribe to a podcast so this one will automatically show up in her feed for her next walk. Thanks for all your support of the podcast. See you next time with more inspired and inspiring people who are on a mission.